Hello and welcome to Here's Where It Went Wrong, the podcast where every week we have on one of our favorite comedians to talk about one of their favorite subjects, and we trace its history to find out exactly where it all went off the rails. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Andrew Nadeau. Andrew, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing so good. This was a fantastic episode. This was so much fun, and please tell us a bit about our guest, too.
Oh, we had on Eliza Skinner, and I try not to nerd out too much. I'm a huge fan of Eliza for a while now. I've followed her on Twitter. I love her work, her show that she's the head writer of, Earth to Ned, on Disney Plus. I say it in the episode, but it is a Venn diagram of things that are totally my shit, which is late night television and Jim Henson Company puppetry. And you really liked her album, right?
I did. She has this great album, Regarding My Lovers, and she also has a great podcast too, a cool playlist pod. But her album, she does the first half joke, second half singing. She does it absolutely everything, and she's good at all of it, and brilliant, as we found out today. And I think I got a text from you the day you found Earth to Ned, and we're just like, they made this show specifically for me.
I think before I even knew like anything about it, I just saw the news drop that Disney Plus is doing a late night show with puppets from the Jim Henson Company, and I was just like, how is somebody reading my diary and getting shows approved over at Disney for it?
It's it was great, and Eliza Skinner is their head writer and does a fantastic job, so we asked her to join us today. She helps us dive deep into the entire history of the internet and social media. We discuss how it was invented by ARPA, to the incredible technological changes, to some absolute disasters, and finally where it went wrong in social media, which we love but has some huge messes, so we really got into it today.
Yeah, so hey, let's dive right in. Eliza Skinner, thank you so much for coming on today. Oh, I'm so excited for this one. I'm scattered right now. let me.
Thanks for having me. How about that?
I know. I feel like this is one of the shows where we did a show right before the election where it was just like 24 hours of tension and then relief and then right into recording. And I feel like this is the same thing where I'm so excited to be here, but also my body has not learned to untense yet. So
yeah. Sorry. Okay.
But we're going to keep all this in. Eliza, thank you so much for coming on. We have both been fans of yours for quite a while. You were one of the first names that we talked about when we started talking about the show. So we really appreciate you being here.
Oh, cool. That's nice. Thank you.
And I know you have a lot going on at the moment, but Earth to Ned specifically, Wen and I have talked about a couple times. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah. Earth to Ned is a show on Disney Plus. It's a talk show hosted by aliens. The aliens were built by the Jim Henson Company. It's produced by Disney Plus and Jim Henson, and I'm the head writer and co-EP of it, and it was really fun to work on. I was shocked at how much they let me do, how much my weird brain ended up in that show. But yeah, it was a really great experience, and I hope we get to make more.
Absolutely.
I hope so too, because it's so amazingly weird, and it's just the combination of late night talk show and Henson stuff is like, it's just like the perfect Venn diagram where I'm just watching it going like, this is a show made specifically for me. And I don't know how economically that makes sense for Disney Plus, but I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, we got a lot of memos about you and had a lot of meetings. It's also a show made for me. You know, I've worked on so many different late night shows and been a fan of that. And I grew up on Henson stuff. You know, so much of my sense of humor was molded by the Muppets. So yeah, it was really like a great opportunity to use my skills. Like it really felt like, oh, great. All this stuff that I packed into my brain fits this show exactly. That's fun. That makes me feel useful.
It's just a great love letter to late night shows. And like, you could just tell that, you know, the Onion article where it's, I appreciate the Muppets on a much deeper level than you. Yeah. I feel like anyone who relates to that, this show was made for you.
I think Muppets are the only topic where Wen and I both said we have to talk about the Muppets, and then both said, but they didn't go wrong, right? We can't, can we not do the Muppets? They're just too good all the time.
I just love the Muppets so much.
Yeah. They're great. It's, you know, they're almost like a combination of a modern commedia and modern like tarot or zodiac. Like everyone is like knows which Muppet they are. Like, you know, I'm a a Gonzo with a piggy rising. And it makes so much sense, but no sense at all.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely true. Like this was obviously, you know, Harry Potter stepped in and he had to be houses instead. But no, there was just this ultimate relatability. So absolutely fantastic. And every time I see a new Jim Henson project, I'm instantly in. It's amazing how often they're all so good.
Yeah. And it's a great company to work for. Also worked for a lot of different companies, and the amount of trust they had in me and all the writers and in everyone in every department. It was a really great show to work on because every department was excited to do their job and to push the boundaries of what could be done with their job in service of all the other departments also. So like the art department was like just stoked to do art, and how can they make our jokes even better with their art? And like the camera department was like stoked to get like perfect shots and light it. And a lot of times you have people kind of like looking over each other's shoulders in shows, like, well, I have thoughts on what your department is doing. And instead of just getting into the joy of their thing. So it was a really happy place to work also. And I was just really honored to get to work with such amazing, weird artists across the board. We had these great people who were like in charge of making clothes for Clods. Like, what?
Right.
That's a job? And there was a guy who was in charge of the animatronics inside Ned's head who like has a piece at LACMA or at the Smithsonian, I think also at LACMA. But like it was just such a fun, fascinating set to be on.
I'm sure incredible. Just the joy of it just kind of shines through in the entire production. And then to bring in Andy Richter as the first guest in a show like that, it just, I could not love it more. I think it's so fantastic. Guys, if you're listening and you haven't checked out Earth to Ned, it's not like super topical or anything. You can pick up anywhere. You can watch any episode, even though it's a late night show. It's not topical. Watch it. It's fantastic. Yeah. If you love the Muppets show and all that, it is definitely in that vein. And I could not love this more.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's really nice.
Of course.
Today, we wanted to talk about, too, the history of social media, which also was the history of the internet, which I thought, oh, this will be a cool thing to dive into because it's got so much background. And it does. And this is not my field at all. And going through this, it all felt so incredibly stiff. But I still want to get into it because a lot of it was very cool. But we also have social media, which has been responsible for, let's start with social media, then I can get into some of the history. That has been largely responsible for most of when in my career, and I know it's had a big impact on yours as well. Obviously, a lot of it terrible, which we're going to get into too. But I mean, Twitter was our base. I mean, that was, Wen and I met off that too. We met up in Chicago and decided to produce a show at IO together after knowing each other through Twitter. So, I mean, your background here has been pretty similar, right?
Yeah, I guess I started in improv and then moved to stand up and stuff. But as far as Twitter, when I first started out, women weren't given a whole lot of respect in the comedy community in New York. The successes that we got were very often like, oh, well, it's not that you're funny or have a writing good jokes or have a good comedic brain. It's that you're pretty. So audiences think that you're pretty. Or for me, like, oh, you can sing. So they like the way that sounds. And Twitter was a chance to just be words, just words on a page. Are they funny or are they not? And I think a lot of women in comedy found success there, and it led to job opportunities because it was like, well, you know, these jokes aren't being boosted by if I curled my hair or not. It's just, do you think they're funny or not? And if I can write here well, then I can probably write well for Joan Rivers. And that was the first job I got, largely based off of people who already knew me from the comedy community, seeing my tweets and being like, oh, she's actually writing jokes. She's actually funny.
Right.
We hadn't noticed when we were face to face with her.
When you're not forcing her to sing, she's actually a great joke writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm funny in the songs too, but yeah. So I think it was good for me, and it was, I think, good for a lot of women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for us, the build has been when you have obviously a theater background as mine. Well, mine was stand up. And then, yeah, the you know, aside from a general hellscape, it also has the purity of jokes, which is nice to just have the writing out there. But let's get a bit into the history of the internet here that led to the social media. So let's Let's start with World War II.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
We're going way back for this.
Man, all right.
So World War II, they started trying to make computers work together. At this point, computers were basically just solving math problems. And for one computer to solve one math problem, obviously a complex one, those that are being used to create the atomic bomb, this can take months. So the idea now is just find a way to link up computers somehow. Richard Feynman, who of course was a famous physicist overall and big in the Manhattan Project, came up with a method to allow computers not currently being used to solve one problem to work on different problems.
They're like backups for the main computer.
Right. So one problem still took the same amount of time, but they could now solve 3 to 4 problems during the same period. So when one's working on one thing. So yeah, Feynman doing something cool before all of the, you know, general philandering, which we have other fine. We'll do a 5-minute episode at some point. They're also able to have multiple computers work on the same problem. This allowed answers to be checked. I remember reading stories about the Manhattan Project where, like, all of this was so new and the stuff they're doing was so groundbreaking that they were waking up in cold sweats and going to check the bomb, and because they had a nightmare, a wire was in the wrong place. And sometimes it was.
Well, yeah, because they were working on nuclear bombs, Andrew. Like, I hope that's a high-stress situation.
It is, and it absolutely makes sense. It was just the idea of, like, you mean that wire wasn't in the right place until you woke up at 3 a.m. and went and moved it around.
They're just like new parents. Yeah. You know? Awakening. Is the baby alive? Oh, God, good. It is.
I work tech support for workout belts, and I wake up in cold sweats about it. So I can't imagine if you have a nuclear bomb in the place where you're currently sleeping. Yeah, you're going to wake up.
Well, but they didn't know. They didn't know what nuclear bombs were. Yeah. They were making them for the first time.
They don't know how big that boom's going to be. They're making new booms.
Well, you picture it as being, because it was groundbreaking, but you also picture it being like fresh off the line, shiny. This thing had duct tape on it. You know, they had to put it together. Like, it wasn't mostly duct tape. It had a good design, but they had to put it together. So this is where computers start. They're like, cool, we're going to have computers figure out a way to check out the math here. Then they start getting colleges involved. They began separating computer terminals from where someone would type their program from the computer itself. This got more people involved. You could allow people to experiment with the machines while keeping more delicate circuits and tubes protected. But this is still all hardwired, but it's seen as an early step toward cloud computing. And then you have the introduction of ARPA, whose job at this point is basically just stay ahead of the Soviets in tech. That's all they want to do.
Is ARPA a person?
ARPA is Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Okay, because you said who, so I was like, who is this ARPA lady?
Oh, yeah. You're right.
No,
right.
Okay.
ARPA is now DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Because immediately they're just like, we're going to make this a war thing.
Well, that's how you get more money for it, right? Right.
Exactly.
It is one of the most well-funded aspects of anything in the government, with a 5% success rate. Every weird project, when they tried to make robot bees, that was DARPA.
I was not aware of
that. When they tried to make the liquid Terminator from Terminator 2, I mean, it was programmable metal, that was DARPA.
Have they made the pink stuff from, was it Deep Blue? No. The Abyss?
Oh, God, that stuff was terrifying when I was a kid. Yeah. If they do, that'll be DARPA.
The robot bees thing is Black Mirror. The T2 stuff is clearly Terminator 2 stuff. So basically, I feel like these people's jobs is to watch movies and be like, we can do that.
Well, that's actually a thing. I went to a talk, one of those Q&As, whatever they call them, at South by Southwest a few years ago, that actually like a decade ago almost. Anyway, about it was by a I forgot what he was called. It was the name of something like a futurist or whatever, but he was talking about his gig, which is basically a lot of tech companies employ sci-fi writers because their philosophy is, we can make anything. We just have to come up with the ideas of what to make, and we're not sure. So they like do read a whole bunch of sci-fi, and then cool stuff. They're like, that guy, her, let's get them in here, right, and they'll tell us what we need to make. And they do.
That's fair, because iPads are basically the little tablets from Star Trek that somebody was just like, we could figure that out. And they did. Yeah. They like, so I guess I'm not fully knocking the watching movies and seeing if a good idea could stick. But I just feel like when you're just like, let's make a Terminator, like you obviously weren't like absorbing the lessons from Terminator. You were just kind of watching Terminator.
Well, that's always a problem. Anytime somebody's working on robot technology, I'm like, so you've seen none stories about robots? None of them? Because they all end up with this. Either it's because they love us so much they have to protect us from ourselves, or they go rogue and they want to murder us. Like, it's one way or the other, they murder.
Absolutely never gone well. And so when we're destroyed by advanced technology, it's going to be DARPA. Also, at one point, this was during one of the James Bond movies, I think it was Thunderball, where he's got this underwater scene where they give him this little...
You could honestly make up any title and I would believe that. Yeah. It was a James Bond movie, by the way.
Yeah, there's so many of those. You could really just throw out ridiculous. Whatever you want. But yeah, Thunderball.
A good murder to die. Right. Time for killing. It's a kill.
Honestly, every James Bond movie title sounds like it is a bad different language translation of a James Bond movie title.
Yeah, it's like they roll the like dice with a few words on them and whatever. They're like, well, it looks like Game to Die is the name of this one. All right. Oh, kill her now.
Yeah.
Okay, kill her now. I don't know, this could be scary, but... Like,
James Bond will return in A Gun for Yesterday. It's
like, exactly. There you go.
Everyone's favorite is
Her
A Majesty's Gun for Yesterday.
Her Majesty's Yesterday Gun.
Like, I want these to be more... I kept thinking one of these is going to be more insane, but no, they have, like, Man with the Golden Gun. Thunderball, I believe, was a legitimate title. They're absolutely insane.
Moonraker, you got to tip your hat to.
Right.
Okay.
There's got to be
Octopussy,
one person who is not at all involved in writing the script, who is just coming up with the title, because there's no way you would guess the script from the title.
Yeah, probably like whoever does the headlines for the Daily Mail.
Right.
Like one of those really punny ones.
All the people who write the articles are like, I don't write the headlines. And the headline writer just gets to enjoy anonymity and just being like, what bullshit will get clicks today? That's making James Bond movie titles.
Yeah. So... In Thunderball, they've got this scene where you're swimming underwater and they give them this little pocket breather. They're like, this is going to let you breathe for 5 minutes. And the CIA calls them after the movie comes out and said, we need this device. Can you give this to us? And they said, we can cut. He couldn't breathe underwater for 5 minutes. He breathed for like 4 to 5 seconds and then we cut and then he did it again.
Yeah, like we can give it to you, but it's a prop. It doesn't do anything.
So, also, would James Bond be interested in working with us? Right. We love his work.
Seems like a good spy. I mean, not yeah. that he's a spy.
So, yeah, this is how they have ARPA now, who's like, okay, well, the James Bond guys can't give it to us, so I guess we got to do it ourselves, and it very rarely works. But they did also create the internet. This was something they actually achieved, as well as the mouse. DARPA was the one that invented the mouse. So we use some of
this computer stuff.
The computer mouse. And GPS, okay. They've done some actual accomplishments. They've also just done the craziest, stupid things out there.
Every device, I feel like you should tell me the accompanying movie that it came from.
Yeah. Actually, that would be fascinating. Like, yeah, I mean, we know most of the stuff at this point is showing up in a movie before it's showing up in real life.
Look, we know Steamboat Willie inspired the mouse. We all know that.
Yeah, it does feel like there's so much stuff in movies that, like, looking back, I'm like, that didn't even exist then. And now it's like, I'm hearing like, oh, well, it did. It just only existed for the government.
Right.
Like, I don't know if you, did you guys see Pretty in Pink?
Yeah,
of course.
Do you remember the scene where they're like chatting on the computers in the library and one of them is like, who is this? And they like put up a full picture. It's like, like a color picture. Like, do you know who I am? And like at the time I was like, that's what? Right. You can't do that. Are there computers that can do that? And apparently, yes.
There were.
It was the CIA's.
I'm not sure if I should tell this story. I'll figure it out later. I'll say it. So I have a friend whose parent, like, has a parent that worked in the CIA.
Sure.
And they
a
were
parent that did?
A parent, yeah.
Oh, a parent. Okay. I was like, wow.
A parent. And they had a parent.
If the CIA has parents, eventually they got to rehome them, right? Yeah. So you might... end up with some sort of bird with spy technology.
Just a parrot that just yells Soviet secrets that it overheard over the course of a lifetime.
Ah, KGB!
No, yeah. A parrot that worked for the CIA, and they were just like, oh yeah, we had satellites that could read license plates in the 80s. And I was like, you had what now? Like, I feel like that is still insane technology, and you had that back, that can't be. And they're like, there are a few drinks in, and they're like, oh, I probably shouldn't have said that. And they just kind of...
I was going to say, I don't think their parents should have told them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty sure their parents should have been telling them that either. I feel like there's a lot of trickle down issues here.
Well, but then you also run into if like parents lie to their kids to try to keep them in line. So could have been that where it's like, well, you better eat your vegetables. Don't sneak them off your plate. We've got satellites that can see you doing that. They can read license plates so they can see what happens to those carrots.
And you know,
we're
going to
build this in that this could be a lie so that we don't have to cut it.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, ARPA at this point is basically trying to figure out packet switching, which is, you know, in the old movies when they make a phone call and they've got the switchboard, they have people having to plug in actual lines because lines need a physical connection.
A river runs through it. Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. So that's how it still works, but now it's automated. So the internet was going to work like that. But you had different connections and the stuff is supposed to be instantaneous and you couldn't have plugging in and going back and forth. So yeah, they had to find a way that they could bypass this manual switching, because even if it was automated for computers, it would mean millions of physical circuits constantly flipping, often just for a split second before it switches off and another one switches on. It was just impossible. So they developed packet switching, where different computers send messages along the same set of wires instead of each getting one.
This sounds like such a hot room.
That was actually my thought too, where it was like, this can't be, there are going to be so many fires. This is not sustainable.
Like the fans that would have to be going along with each of these switching things.
Right.
Like, just the droning heat of whatever room all of this would be taking place in.
Just the thought of me switching tabs on my current Google like pull up is like in someone having to be like, oh shit, like having to unplug and replug every time I switch between those tabs. I feel terrible for them.
Right. So this is supposed to be automated, but they obviously realize we can't do this. So they come up with packet switching where they send along the same wires, which is also where they decide, you know what, we already have phone lines wired throughout the whole country, so let's just use those. And which made sense, but one thing that's also not considered is that phone lines are designed to register human voices, and data moves much faster at higher frequencies, which phone lines aren't set up to be able to read. So this was a bit later, back in the 80s, but they have to start sending out test signals here, and basically every time you turn the internet on, it is testing your phone line to see how high a screech it can handle to actually send data across.
Wait, is that why my computer yelled at me in the early aughts?
I could not
90s?
Get confirmation of that. I really wondered if that was true, or if that was automated, but that was what the conclusion I came to too. It felt like it could be internal, but either way, they have to test the phone line every time and it was just not working.
I don't know. I think those noises in the aughts, that was just about respect.
Yeah. I feel like just showing us who's
hey,
in charge.
This is some for real shit, and you don't understand it. Right. So,
it's like the orchestra tuning up before a musical. It's just like, exactly. Look, we're preparing you for a whole new world, and you like this is our prelude. You're easing you into it right now. Right. The curtain's about to go up, baby.
Especially if they're tuning up for a performance of The Little Mermaid. But they, I had a friend in the 80s when I was a little kid. He was like an older boy down the block, and his mom's boyfriend worked, I think, for IBM, but whatever, they had this thing. They had like a modem that he would dial the phone, like push button dial, and then put the handset on this modem thing. And like it had like these rubber things that kind of fit around the receiver and just jam it into that and then log into some sort of rudimentary connect. I don't know if it was just a connection with like the office or whatever, but we were very like, whoa, we're in war games now.
Right.
This is pretty much war games.
At this point, there a lot of these companies had their own networks. So you had ARPANET was obviously ARPA's. You had a lot of colleges had their own, large companies had their own, NSF, who eventually took over control once ARPA, they said, okay, our goal was to make this and we made it and we can't really kill people with it. So does anybody else want to run it? And National Science Foundation already had their network set up. It's
well,
like, yeah,
ARPA
cool,
being
we'll do it.
So short-sighted. Yeah. You know, just wait 30 years or so. You can get people to kill
gonna
themselves
come back
with
around.
It.
So yeah, NSF takes this over. They're making a lot of advances, but they've still got all the separate networks. And also it is, as you said, this is still reserved for private companies, except some of the companies are leasing out access in off hours, which is, you know, not really allowed, but it's kind of testing it at this point. They start getting email up and running very quickly. One of the problems they have early on is just the fact that everything has to have a registered address and they need a place to keep all of this, which ends up being Stanford. And every time someone like unplugged the computer and plugged it back in, the address changed and it had to be kept up to date because these things, it couldn't be sent from one place to another very easily. So it'd be sent from place to place to place to place, often as it, you know, is still done now. But if one was wrong, it wouldn't go through. So the level of hot mess in the beginning was intense here.
Yeah, it does not sound very secure.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely a mess. So they say, look, we can't all keep this because it used to be you had the list on your desk and you'd flip flip through it and you'd have to plot who was the closest place to you to the closest place that you could send it to within that distance, and then the closest place to them, closest place to the place you were sending it to. And, you know, maybe you can make it in five jumps.
This sounds like cans with strings attached.
That's what it was. Which is why eventually they said, look, Stanford, you do it. Stanford's like, okay, cool, I guess.
You guys
guess
seem smart, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is as smart as we can get. We're done. Any more smart needs to be somebody else.
Right. This is how we end up with IP addresses and domain names, because they need a better system to improve that. But all of this is interesting, but also very dry. And I don't think our audience can take that much. So we're going to skip ahead here to...
Okay, this must be where Al Gore comes in then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Single-handedly building the series of tubes that would become the internet.
Creating the internet and being born.
Yeah. So we're going to skip right ahead to the 90s, which we've gone back and forth in a little bit. But at the 90s, at this point, it starts being released to the public. At this point, you also have ISPs and people can access it. And when I started with the internet, we had that monthly plan where we had a certain number of hours of internet you could use per month, which is one of those things I keep thinking back on. I'm like, did I imagine this? Was this really how it worked, that we had limited?
And they would send those CDs out.
Right.
Yes, those little AOL CDs.
100 free hours or whatever.
Right. Which also, considering it took me like an hour and a half to load one game on Neopets, there was no way that we had enough time for the internet. Also, I just remember my dad being like, you can learn so much stuff here. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? You want me to just go stare at pictures from a museum? I am 12 and this is the most exciting thing in my life. I'm gonna go and do dumb shit really fast.
Yeah, I remember it being like a notable thing when some store or restaurant or whatever had a website. Like, it was one more thing that you could do. Like, whoa, KB Toys has a site?
Right.
Cool, I can look at it. And it would have like some flashing icons and the address of the real place. And like,
right.
That's it.
And no, I mean, they would, every, whether you were a professional or amateur, all the websites looked exactly the same. It was, you had some sort of glowing, shiny font and something you could click on and absolutely nothing you could do with
it. Yeah, I remember looking at them and being like, what are these for? I mean, cool, I guess, but what am I supposed to, right. What do you do with this? Yeah. Why is this valuable to anyone?
I only used it to make video games easier to play for myself, because I would like print all the cheat codes off and then I would just like bring them to sleepovers in a little binder and be like, I got these off the net.
Yeah.
So that was me.
We're all making great use of the internet as children. But at this point, too,
it's not like
also
I'm doing
have...
any better with it now, Andrew.
Right. This is what we're doing with the internet now. It's like we're not thriving.
This
here.
Show.
Yeah. So you've also got things like Netscape appearing. Like, okay, cool. People have the internet now. They need a way to access the things on the internet. So Netscape appears in 1994, and the internet is now publicly accessible. The number of computers using the internet exploded in the 90s, and billions of dollars were thrown into internet startup companies. If you said you had an idea to do something on the internet, you were given more money than you could carry.
Yeah, I remember that. And I also remember being like, as I said, what is this for? Where is the money? I remember my dad was really upset at my mom. Like in the 90s, one of the things that came up in family fights.
Yeah.
One of the things that came up in family fights was my dad being like, I could have bought Netflix stock and she wouldn't let me. We'd be millionaires now. And now I'm sort of like, hey, good thing you didn't buy the Netflix stock, right? I mean, right. Where would it be? But so my dad considered himself like an internet he could have been an internet mogul. So like he got it.
Yeah.
And I remember having a lot of conversations with him where I'm like, I don't understand why any of this is valuable. Where's the actual thing? Where's the money exchange? And he's like, it's a very lucrative field. I'm like, but why? And I felt so stupid. And I was like, oh, I don't understand this thing that everybody else understands. And then I was right.
Yeah, I was about to say, you predicted the .com
there was
bubble bust.
You asked the question that not a single investor thought to ask. I think it was one of those, it was just very Emperor's New Clothes. Nobody wanted to admit that they had $1 billion and didn't understand how computers worked.
Yeah, it was just like, oh, a lot of people are using this thing.
Yeah.
Okay, are they spending money on it? I mean, if you're selling computers, good, or... if you're, I don't know, reselling those AOL discs.
Right.
Although there's so many free ones. I don't know if you could do that. I remember there was I saw an article about some building in New York in Soho, I think, that it was all wired. This was when video was really new, like right around 2000, like video on the internet, but they had cameras everywhere. And their whole thing was just like having their whole life be constantly streamed. And like that was like a huge thing. And that I was like, again, where's the money? Yeah. How do they, this project had gotten them enough money to have a whole building in Soho.
Right.
And yet it did nothing. Like they actually probably made reality television and yet they didn't figure out how to monetize it worth shit.
Well, yeah. And because of this, when the bubble burst, literal trillions of dollars were lost. Number too big to imagine. And what happened here, because this was also around a confluence of events like the lawsuit with Napster, because at this point, the internet was, it was fairly wild. There wasn't much regulation. You also had Microsoft at the same time violating antitrust laws. And this led to setting up guidelines for what was and wasn't allowed online. This allowed the companies that did survive to become a lot more stable, but it also meant they grew into empires that could shut everybody else out. That's how you end up with Google and Yahoo, although not the tower it once was. It was all these little companies bombed, and you have Amazon and Google just absolutely fly and shut it down for everyone else. And obviously the growth has been good for a lot of stuff, but it would be cool. I mean, because the destruction of mom and pop stores by the internet is discussed often, but like mom and pop stores online were destroyed by the internet too. There were some creative startups that just could not compete with these new restrictions put up. But I think that brings us to about the start of the social media side, because one of the casualties of the dot-com bubble was GeoCities, which is one of the first social networking sites. And what was interesting about this was before GeoCities came online in 1994, there was a clear divide between creators and users. Users visited creator sites and looked at whatever had been put there without interaction. And GeoCities allowed users to use their site to create their own sites with their own formatting and background and content. And everyone with a GeoCities account was a user and a creator. And you could message with other users and join groups of pages with similar topics and interests. And in 1999, GeoCities' 19 million users made it the third most popular site behind only AOL and Yahoo. Yahoo bought it that year for $3.6 billion, but was hit hard during the dot-com burst. And finally, GeoCities wasn't shut down until 2009. Nobody was using GeoCities. It was around for a while. I had a GeoCities site that was terrible. I assume you guys did too.
I did not have a site. I was just a big fan of learning nerd shit that nobody else would possibly know, like anime and Star Wars. Like as a kid, like I would just come out with like all this knowledge that everyone was just like, how do you know that? I'd be like, hopefully some guy's not lying to me.
Well, in my pursuit of trying to figure out why this thing was valuable, I learned HTML and I was like trying to put together websites. I definitely had a website that was just like HTML. And it did not do much or say much, but I'm pretty sure I had a GeoCities one also, like thinking like, oh, this will be easier. I can just put some stuff in here. But I think like right around here is like, I know you're moving towards social media, but I would also say that a big important part of this was the value of a comment section on all websites. Websites realized like say the New York Times, any website with writing on it, but any website, they realize that people go to them more if there's a comment section, if there's interaction. So they're like, well, we have to make room for people to interact. So after we do our reporting that we spend lots and lots of time on and money, we'll just put a thing at the bottom where anybody taking a shit can write, I disagree. And there are lizard people. Yeah. And that gets to be on the same fucking page as everything else.
No, and I think you nailed it. And I think that is actually the where it went wrong.
Oh, sorry. Did I skip to it?
No. We're going right into
it. But it's perfect. Still right in the flow.
It is.
I was like, let's not skip this.
No, because you're right. At this point, it's being developed where, again, GeoCities did the everyone's a creator. And then they started with like, oh, okay, there are creators here and you can be a creator or a user. And then they did that. We're going to straddle the line. You can talk to your favorite creators. And this is where everything got so fucked up because it was power and anonymity just thrown together in a brand new world. And it gave the worst people the access they had desired so bad.
And it put things on like the same level. Like again, New York Times or whatever, you've got a department that is fact-checking things, that is calling people up and being like, is your last name really Smith? Okay, good. Cause that's what we say in the article. Bye.
Yeah.
And then again, nobody McNoberson's who doesn't know really anything that they're writing, it would be a weird coincidence if they did happen to have some expertise in what they're commenting on, but just anybody can come. it's like if the nightly news, which I don't like, I'm ancient and don't agree with round the clock news. So I like
also,
yeah. I agree.
I like a one shot news program.
Right.
If the nightly news was like, all right, so here's our 30 minutes of news and now 45 minutes of comments from random people about their thoughts on it. Good night. Yeah. And yeah. Like, what? That should not be part of it. I should not. That, why is this on the same page?
You're right. And I think that was the big issue, too, is was that it was received as if because I said it as well, we're equivalent. And somehow that has still never been broken. It's still taken the same. They still read comments on the news.
Like, yeah. And it also made it into, it made everything into an opinion.
Yes.
So if you're like reporting on, I don't know, some hurricane and a commenter is like, I don't really think hurricanes are that big a problem. Like,
right.
Well, what? That's not, it still happened.
Right.
It's still, like what? Like anyone's feelings on something were placed in the same place as facts,
yeah,
about that thing.
And it's a huge issue. And I think one of the aspects here that matters is that it was not treated like the extreme it was, because news organizations were still saying we have to cover both sides instead of saying this isn't a real side. This isn't a matter of opinion. We're talking about fact versus is opinion. And in that case, you can just cover the fact. That's an okay thing to do. But the response instead was like, oh, no, we have to treat these as equal. It's like these are not in any way equal.
Also, I wonder if it made it okay to be inane.
Yeah. Just like
to have like, yeah, to be reporting on like some sort of like, see, read some like important discussion. And then somebody's like, my daughter-in-law won't talk to me anymore. So I'm sad and crying on my cat. Like, right. Okay, what? That's a part of it. Why is that part of it?
I mean, it gives anybody a chance to say anything that they want for attention. And also you get rewarded for saying the most outlandish or out there or most passionate thing, because that gives you people commenting on what you're saying now. So now the whole comment section is now validating or invalidating a person's strongly held belief or opinion, whereas we're not actually going through and being like, no, that guy's name is Mr. Smith. They called him and confirmed it.
Right.
They're like, yeah. Well, guess what? I've been calling him Jimmy McFuckface for 20 years. So that's, yeah, his name to me. And everyone's now, that's the debate.
And
now,
as Andrew said, like, that anonymity was key for that, because that meant that you get the dopamine when people agree with your comment. You get to be like, I'm the one who did that. But if people bag on it, that's not me. That's Wafflemaker67.
Right.
Who the, yeah, fuck is that? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think it is this because so many people are doing it. All they want is the attention. So saying the most incorrect thing possible gets it for them. Plenty of people are just horrible and believe it sincerely and are, you know, for whatever reason are need to engage and are going to be horribly racist because of what they believe. But there are also plenty that are just doing it because it's the same thing as a 3-year-old that just is throwing a fit. They just need the attention, and you've got a billion people reading it and giving it to them.
Well, and I wonder if that normalized seeing a lot of 3-year-olds throwing fits.
Yeah.
I mean, adults be acting like 3-year-olds throwing fits. You know, we've had terrible politicians and politics for the entire history of this country and beyond. But yeah. I also kind of feel like we're like, yeah, yeah. Well, an option of a way you can be is loud and dumb. Right. And then we eventually elected someone who was loud and, right, dumb in a dangerous way and believed that opinions belonged on the same page as facts.
No, and I think you're right. And obviously there is a lot that is discussed with the structure of how information is output and received. Also, obviously, there are a lot of issues with voting structure that are an absolute travesty that skews it very much. But there's also the fact that, yeah, this is put out there as if it's equivalent. And that,
yeah,
is so
it just
dangerous.
Normalizes.
Yeah.
And have you seen what happens when they turn off a comment section? Like, all other comment sections on that page are now like, they won't let us speak our minds on this issue anymore. It's just like, no, you're like you cannot just get mad that you can't say whatever you want under a very serious article. And they're like, this is going to be bullshit. We're just going to turn off the comments. And then your whole website gets attacked. for like, they have attacked the New York Times for turning off comment sections before, and it's just wild to see. Also, when you go into things like social media, we try to, you know, make it a democracy in like what people want to see, and it turns out we are terrible.
They want to see bad shit.
We're terrible at that. We don't want to see like fun stuff. We don't want to like, you don't really look, seek out news that makes you happy. Like, everyone seeks out news to make them mad. I mean, we're recording this, you know, April 20th, the same day as the show.
Oh,
the weed day. But if we're going into it, we're also the day of the Derek Chauvin trial. It's not his trial. Chauvin was on trial. Sorry, that was a slip
up
on my part.
The defense often made it sound like it was his trial.
Gosh. But then immediately after, you have people, and these right-wing people that just want to get a lot of clicks. They want to get a lot of eyeballs on their stuff. So they just start putting up the most heinous and hateful and ridiculous things they can. And now, if you look at the trending topics, they're the two biggest search names right now. I'm not going to say their names here because fuck those guys.
Right.
But like, they know how to get people saying their name a lot. And to them, that's clicks and that's eyeballs. And that's what we let news be now.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, the comment section became its own website.
Exactly.
Yeah. God, that is poignant and terrifying, but that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, they're like, we don't even need the article anymore. We just do this yelling at each other. And while they went and made a lot of comment sections on other websites moderated and or made people start using their real names, not on Twitter. You don't gotta use your real name. You could have a different name every day of the week, baby. Yeah.
Is it Halloween? Make your name spooky. You can do whatever you want here. There are no rules.
But I mean, you can like people make up all these fake accounts. It doesn't act.
What's so scary to me is the level that it has bled into the rest of the world without the rest of the world acknowledging that this is the effect directly from this, that it was not that long ago that opinions weren't treated equivalent to fact. It wasn't that long ago that you had to earn a space to talk about something. And not that there weren't a ton of issues with how that space was earned. There were plenty of people excluded because of it.
Yeah. And in that sense, it has been great that it's provided a platform for different types of voices.
But we need a way to determine whether or not, or who that voice is and whether or not it's credible. And when I was looking into the history of this, I was trying to determine what exactly was the first form of social media. And one of the opinions I found on this was the telegraph, because it was an attempt to communicate.
Tell me
electronic,
more.
it was a message being sent electronically with the intent of personalized communication. So it considered this, it was a stretch in terms of social media, but it was indicating it as a form of this. So I started looking into this a bit more. And it said, 1844, Samuel Morse sends the very first message by telegraph from D.C. to Baltimore. And the message reads simply, "What have God wrought?" And the level of foreshadowing for what social media would become is
what
so
monster
insane.
Be here.
I feel like if you ever invented something in the past, you had to say something really dramatic the first time you used it.
Right.
Like what have God wrought? And then like, you know, you drop the first bomb and you're like, I've become death, the destroyer of worlds. Like, you have to say something, or you have to lie and say you said something incredibly insightful when you first used
it. Except for Alexander Graham Bell, who's just like, what's and come check this shit out. That's a rough translation. That's
his writer probably quit.
Yeah.
Ahoy hoy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't believe that all these people came up with this stuff themselves. I think they had writers.
Sure.
Also, you know, frequently last words aren't, that's not people's
of course.
Words. You're not on your deathbed being like, oh, I feel like my butt's exploding out of my mouth. Remember me with this poetry. Like, no, you're just like, you're just busy dying at that point.
Your brain's just firing synapses. You're not actually coming up with pure poetry to say in this moment.
But you've hopefully chosen yourself already your official final words.
No, if I say something cool enough, I want it to be my last words, I'm just shutting up forever. That's it. I'm just keeping it going until it ends.
Or just like keep it in a little piece of paper in your wallet so you can just repeat it, especially after you say something dumb.
Right. That's it. I'll just immediately say something dumb and immediately follow with something cool just in case I'm hit by a bus. Right then.
No, that doesn't count anymore. That doesn't count. I said the cool thing again.
So Morse had a good idea of where this was going, apparently. And I mean, I think that is essentially the issue, is just the absolute worst people given a platform without regulation. And not only that, but they're given exactly what they want from doing the worst behavior possible. And then it was just one of those things, again, as it often is with this show, it's just the perfect storm of stupidity where everything happens at once, where the other side is not realizing quickly enough that this is a shift and our behavior needs to shift too. We need a form of a way to regulate. We need to be able to have real names involved. We need to be able to discern fact from opinion and not put them on equal footing. And somehow all of this is missed. And we're just like, instead, well, what if we have a different comment section where we say good things? And that surprisingly has not worked.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, at this point, I fear that we are too far gone from the difference between fact and opinion. No one trusts the sources.
Yeah.
So even if we're like, oh, well, Snopes, for instance, has checked all these things, that people then are like, well, Snopes is part of the cabal or right. whatever the fuck.
No, and I think that's a huge thing. It's like, okay, here's the documented fact. And they're like, okay, well, here's my printout from racism.gov. Why is your thing more legitimate than mine? And you can say, well, here are the sources showing it's legitimate. And they're like, well, here's my printout from my same website saying mine's legitimate.
I just gotta say, Andrew, I really hope the government stops using that domain.
That's a good point. Like racism.gov is probably the issue here. It should be a .com.
There was a time at which I think it was .gop. There was like a fire sale on .gop domain names, and I had some friends who just bought like all kind, like everything they could think of, especially comedy things. Like I think they got like funnyordie.gop and ucb.gop, Second City GOP. Anyway,
look, if you can like squat on a domain name and make a lot of money, I support anyone who does that to somebody that isn't like an individual person. I hate it like when people would do it with like, oh, there's a comedian under this name. Well, I'm just going to take that domain. There's that, those assholes.
Oh, but yeah, I've had that happen to me.
Yeah,
but if you're able to fuck over like a corporation or somebody who would be like Ted Cruz's .gop website, fuck that guy.
But also, I think it's that like most of those places wouldn't want the .gop website. And so it's like, well, you're going to stop me from putting whatever I want on it?
Right.
And also just you get to just bragging rights.
For sure. Oh,
for sure. Why do anything on the internet?
Okay. So here's the problem though. So as we've said, social media has allowed for a lot of voices. I mean, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, like different voices to be heard in a way that they weren't before. So there's that on the one hand, which I think is important and valuable and probably a large part of the good shifts in the shifts that I think the three of us would consider good in our society. And we're right.
Yeah.
We're always right on this show.
But the other side of it, like I think about how they took Trump off of Twitter.
Right.
And people are like, they're just silencing him. Ah. But it's been like a lot better.
Yeah.
I mean, also he's not president anymore, but like you just don't have to have that clatter. You're not hearing that shit constantly. Then it kind of makes me wonder like, okay, so if someone just like pulled the big Twitter plug, pulled the big social media plug, none of us had it anymore, would that be a way that we start returning to there's a difference between fact and opinion? Like, because you'd have any ideas you're sharing, you would primarily be sharing them face to face, or at least with people that you already know over telephone or whatever. I mean, not that this is going to happen, so whatever. But on the one hand, I do feel like we would have a better and easier time discerning the difference between fiction and reality and fact and opinion. But how could we preserve the more fair platform available to everybody with fewer gatekeepers deciding who gets to be heard and who doesn't?
And I think that is the crux of the issue is that ultimately we have so much more access to true information too. That's a great thing. And also, unfortunately, the right has co-opted the term of facts don't care about your feelings, but then they use opinions and state them as fact. And that's really the issue. Facts don't care about your feelings. By the way, everything I'm saying is a fact. And it's like that I feel like is at the heart of the problem. If anything you believe is a fact and you have no distinction between fact and opinion, I think that's more of the issue than the fact that they're treated equal. It's that they're believed to be the same by so many.
Well, there's also nuance with it, right? Because it's the difference between, like, I could say the sky is blue. I could also say the ominous sky crushing all of us with bad intent, just waiting for its chance, is blue.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like, well, I mean, yeah, the fact part of that was right, but it was colored. I remember. bad choice of words, but the nuance around it was very different. And totally
as somebody who's anti-sky, though, I agree with that. Right. Thing you said. Fuck the sky.
You're right. It's a huge issue where they do the thing where they have one fact and then all the coloration and the opinion around it. And then they're like, but the fact. And it was like, yeah, but the other stuff was there, too. Doesn't that part count? And I don't know. I don't know if it would be better if it was suddenly gone and just left to, because it's not like, you know, it's not like someone is good just because they're an expert, too. There are bad experts. So who is getting the information out there? I love that. I mean, as our listeners know, I love research. I love that I get to do this for the show, that I get to dig deep. And, you know, I found some very cool stuff just for this show where I find an obscure article that or a paper that I had never heard of by an author I'd never heard of. And I get to go deep and find out some very cool stuff. But also, I make sure I'm checking my references when I'm doing that. And this is someone that I can trust and has reliable information. And I think a focus on critical thinking is one of the most important parts of education, and a focus on teaching research. But that is a big step ahead.
Definitely. I definitely agree. Like teaching people how to be discerning with the facts that they cling to. But also, I think not being scared of opinion changing is important, and facts changing, because we learn more. I helped develop and wrote on the first season of Adam Ruins Everything. So for us, that research was really, really important. And one of the episodes I wrote was about medical, like wellness stuff and the food science studies and how easily manipulated they are and how poorly reported they are. Because like a scientific study, that is dry, but right. You see some exciting words in it and you're a reporter and you need to get clicks and your feckin' article with the comment section, and you pull this stuff out and make it seem totally wrong.
Right.
Make bullshit seem true.
You covered the diet chocolate on that episode too, didn't you? Where they made that story go viral?
Yeah. We didn't make a story go viral on my episode.
You covered the story that was made to go viral, as if chocolate could be used for dieting.
Yes, we did.
The misnomer.
And we also got the script of the episode approved and published as a research paper.
That was incredible, by the way. I love that moment so much.
Thank you. But yeah, they don't even read these research papers. So you can send them a TV script and they're like, this is a finding. So I think that some people, there's this idea that if someone comes out and is like, you know what, we were wrong before, we've got more information, or I was wrong before, I've talked to more people and changed my feelings on this, then that somehow negates all information from that source.
Right. People look at it as like a failing. If you're just like, I was wrong. And it's like, well, why should we believe anything this person ever has to say? They were wrong that one time.
Right.
Yeah. Like a lot of people were wrong. This is one that was honest about it.
Right. And I think the idea of switching that approach to if someone has learned something, ideally they know more now. That's why they're able to admit they're wrong, is because they have learned something significant. And the idea that science is fact but not immutable, is a fact with the information we currently have. Sometimes that is enough to be like, this is not going to change. And sometimes we find out about quantum physics and I was like, oh, okay, we have to come up with new rules for absolutely everything we thought we knew. And it happens, and it's not a bad thing. In fact, it's a really exciting thing. But the ability to say I was wrong is a very important step that is hard to do.
Well, and also, like, absolutely it is, and there's a lot of ego involved in it, but also letting people in on the steps you took to learn the new thing. Like, well, now we've done this, and because of this and this and this, we know these new things, and it changes what we know to be true about the world.
I mean, it comes down to the, you know, the 2004 election. If you get into that, like, what was the big thing other than Swift voting? What was the big thing everyone talked about? John Kerry has flip-flopped on his positions. Every article was, he flip-flopped. Like, he changed his mind on this issue. And it was used in every single attack ad. Like, I can clearly remember this. I was 13 when this when that election occurred, and like the thing that it was stuck in my mind, I was in Tennessee and I wasn't as well read at the time, so you can't blame me for this. But the one thing I was like, oh yeah, John Kerry, he flip-flops. And I'm like, what does that even fucking mean? It means he like changed his views over time, like anyone would in their, you know, older years. And for some reason it's become just a terrible thing.
How often is there a flop with these flip-floppers? Usually it's just one it's like, I thought that, oops, I think the other thing now. It's not so often. I thought the other thing. Now, you know, I'm back to that. But anyway, that's just a semantic issue I have. But yeah, I believe like one of my little life philosophies to help me when I learn something new that teaches me that, oh, I was wrong before. I mean, as you said, nobody likes being wrong.
Yeah.
When you learn something new, you kind of have to admit like, ah, the old thing I thought was wrong. I was wrong when I thought that. But you're supposed to be, I think, you're supposed to get smarter every day.
Yeah.
And I think that that's obvious, but also like weird and upsetting to a lot of people. If you don't get smarter every day, then you just stay as smart as you were when you started, when you were what? 10?
Right.
When you set all your opinions in stone and you couldn't move them from that day on.
Yeah. When you were adult, when you turn 18, you knew everything and you don't want to be smarter than when you were 18. Come on.
Right.
Anyway, the comment section ruined the internet.
Yeah.
No. Sorry. I just realized we'd gotten very far from that.
But it all wraps up into each other. But I think we got a good reason for why comment sections ruin the internet, which brings us to the next section of this show, which is in their defense, where one of us has to defend the thing we've just been shitting on for about an hour now. Now, guests usually get first choice if they want to take a crack at it. But me and Andrew have defended worse.
Yeah, honestly, comment section is not the way we had to defend. Burning witches is always my go-to. Comment section, not that bad.
Yeah, well, and burning witches, like, I mean, there's no problem defending that if you're actually burning witches.
Right. Exactly.
It was just burning regular women.
Right.
Yeah. If there were really people like running around stealing babies and like bringing dead goats back from to life, like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we should have had you on that episode. I struggled on that one. That's a good point.
Which is also, it's weird that that happens so often. Like, people love doing that in fiction, like going to the, like, setting something in the witch trials and being like, but they were witches. Like, no,
right.
No, that's not why it was important. It was important. Anyway, that's a different episode you did. I feel like I already touched on the only argument I would be able to make, which is, you know, it let voices be heard that systemically were not, like, people of color, like women, like trans people, all kinds of folks that were not allowed into the places of the platforms of great reach.
Yeah. No, I think that is a huge aspect of it, is that because there were people that did deserve to be heard, that did deserve equal footing, that they just, you know, they just weren't given a byline. And this was a chance to speak out. And that was fantastic. You know, the issue was in all those other people, but it gave a lot of voiceless a chance to speak out. And I think that's the only legitimate argument for one just going on another side. I think personally, I'm aware I get much less hate as a comedian online than any of my women comedian friends, than any of my gay comedian friends. I'm a straight white guy. Occasionally I get anti-Jewish stuff because, you know, I'm Jewish. It happens.
It's one of the oldest prejudices.
Right.
always come back but that'll be there for us.
But even then, talking to, again, my women comic friends that are Jewish, they get far more anti-Semitic hate mail than I do. And I'm aware of the privilege that I have in that it's given me a chance to mostly positively interact with people. There are a lot of annoyances to it, sure, but it has been a chance for me to, as we talked about in the beginning, the chance of writing pure jokes and seeing that response to it. You know, there's nothing like a live audience, obviously, but the idea of someone can tell me why they like the joke and I can say something directly back to them is nice. There are purely good moments that I'm glad I got to share through this, and I wouldn't have had that without this open forum.
Yeah, well, I am a straight white guy who was raised Catholic, so I'm bulletproof on the internet. So you can't even hurt my feelings at this point. I'm kidding, please. Both of y'all could probably devastate me in 2 seconds if you wanted to.
And yeah, there's a lot of anti-Catholic bias there too.
Oh yeah. But every time I have heard, and like, okay, I grew up in like the South where like there was a lot of weird anti-Catholic stuff. Like my wife, like when we first started dating, she had people like asking like, oh, he's Catholic, so you can't, like, that can't be a serious relationship, can it? And it's just like, that's wild. But still, it's like, that's like the little league of prejudices. So I'm not actually I'm not going to be like, oh, whoa,
married,
the Catholics.
It's okay.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to go, whoa, I mean, I'm going to have my heart broken for the Catholics over here. But social media has given, you know, me and Andrew have this show. Me and Andrew have met. Eliza, we're talking to you. This is great. Like, this never
would This is a very cool moment for us.
Yeah, in a world where I did not have access to social media. And I've gotten to speak to a lot of really amazing comics on this show and people that I've met with online just because of social media. And it's an incredible thing. And it is just all a big open comment section. We've gotten so much music from people putting up things on social media. MySpace became a giant music platform. Facebook became a situation where people shared everything. You get Chance the Rapper, you get all these SoundCloud rappers that blow up. It's really given a lot of people in the arts access to things they never would have had because they didn't go to Harvard or they weren't living on the right coast.
Yeah, it definitely helps people find their audience.
Absolutely.
Exactly. The bad thing is it also gives a lot of bad people a chance to find their audience.
And bad ideas a chance to find their audience. Like, I was thinking when you said that thing that people said to your wife that, like, oh, he's Catholic, so this can't be long-term. Well, you actually said, I think someone said that to her. And yeah, like, that's mean, this. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's the sort of thing that, like, it's like, that's not a common, like, massive prejudice. And if you're just talking about people in real life saying something, I'm sorry, I keep having to move my cat who keeps trying to walk across the computer.
It's adorable every time. Like,
people in real life are like coming up to you at the grocery store saying that, like, you can tell that that's like a couple of outliers and what a bunch of weirdos. But the internet.
Oh, the internet. That is.
Those weirdos get to find each other and find even more of each other. So what would have been like the thing that one weird person said at a party and made everybody go, ugh, suddenly is like hundreds of those weird people have found each other. And they're all like, oh, we're all bigoted in the same way. Right. We must be right. Because there's so many of us. If I was just one person at a party thinking this thing, I would think, maybe I'm wrong, but look at me and my 100 crazy friends who think the same thing.
Not only that, but like in real life, unless you actually like had a conversation with me, you're not going to be able to eyeball Catholicism from a mile. Like you'd see the red beard and you'd probably make some assumptions, but like you wouldn't know for sure.
Right. Whereas at now least people a Viking, are like, something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. Now people can just be like, Winslow Powers, Catholic question mark. And they're like, we got him.
Yeah. So it's like, it has gotten, again, audiences for people and audiences for bad ideas. Like, it's created fan bases for both.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And you're right, too, the fact that it has brought them together. Like, I've had jokes where it got almost no laughs, but I had one guy come up and say, oh, my God, that was so funny. And I kept that joke in for far too long.
Because I know the exact joke, Andrew, and I agree you might have kept that one for far too long because of that one guy.
Yeah. I'm very curious which one went into this. We're going to discuss that afterwards. But right, the idea of just that sense of vindication and how long you hold onto belief with just one person telling you, no, this is a good idea. When you find 100 other crazy people that are all willing to back you up, it's like, yeah, that is a much harder, insane idea to let go of.
Yeah, I mean, I always, like, this is a weird way to put this, but I did a show 15 years ago in New York, something like that, where everybody was supposed to be doing 2 minutes of stand-up. It was one of those things where it was like all these different stand-ups. And one guy got up and he was like, well, rather than try to tell any jokes, I'm just going to use this time to talk about which comics I have jerked off to. And he meant female comics. And he started naming female comics and what about that, like the instance that he thinks back to. So he was like, this person, this person. And I was one of the comics. It was there, you know, it was most of us were the people who were in the room that he talked about. And afterwards, all these people were like, oh my God, are you okay? That's terrible. And yes, it was terrible. You should not do that. That's an awful thing. But I was not as wounded as people expected because I was like, oh yeah, I assume everybody's jerked off to everything. Like everyone, like after a while, like your brain is just firing different thoughts. And so after a while you're like, I don't know, a potted plant? Maybe that. maybe Joy Behar and a hose? I don't know. Maybe that, like you try, but you don't hold on to all of those.
Right.
And you're not like, I should, like, even this creepo dude was not like, it's Eliza Skinner every night. She's my brain girlfriend. You know, you just let those weird thoughts go in and out. And you're like, this doesn't define me. But the internet makes people think, yes, these are, don't let that idea fly out your brain window.
Right.
Hold on to it. Make it your whole identity. Because there's 200 other people who were like, oh, I like that idea. Or right. I heard that. I probably didn't need the weird sex story in there. But like, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely.
Like, we've got weird brains.
I think it is a good example of it, that the fact that, yeah, there are most of these things that, and especially once you become more and more online too, and you start posting more and you have these thoughts that you would have just let go. And then it's now like, oh, I need to not only hold on to this, I need to share this. And that is an unhealthy thought process to be in most of the time.
Or it might not be even be one that you shared, but just like some weird thing that popped into your brain. And then you see someone else share something like it.
It's
and
like, you're I'm not alone. Oh,
you know what? I guess it's fine to not wash my legs. Right. Look at how many of us aren't washing our legs.
God, that became huge too.
Yeah. And then people are like, that's fine. It's okay to have moldy legs.
Me and my wife were just like, wasn't that a you're the worst joke from like 3 years ago? Yeah. And everyone's really so doing it?
So many different places. But like, And that's like a funny way to do it. But then it'll also be like racist shit like that,
right?
Or like misogynist shit, like all kinds of bigotry that someone says something. And then someone who had some weird little kernel seed in their brain of the same thing is like, ooh, maybe I can water this and make it a whole tree.
I mean, it's fair. It's like everyone's searching for like the, you know, when they have Jesus in the toast and they're like, well, this confirms my faith now.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They're seeing nonsense toast and being like, well, I it's the truth.
Looks like I've never been wrong a day in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should trust more of these weird feelings that I usually let fly out of my brain window.
Right.
Wow. They're probably great. I was right about the toast.
If the toast backed me up, I'm clearly right to give off my jerk off list for 2 minutes. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. That story ages poorly.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think there was a single day where that story was rad.
Well, no, I mean, it's not like, it wasn't like rat, but I was like, oh man. I mean, you have to understand, being a woman in comedy in the aughts, people are constantly saying sexual shit to you. They're constantly telling you you're only on this show because somebody wants to fuck you. So a guy being like, yeah, here are the times that I've wanted to fuck you, all you people, was like, yeah, that's pretty much the same thing I hear all the time. Whatever. Yeah,
if anything, this is hack. This is hack material.
Which
this
is horrifying that it becomes that normalized, but also like, yeah, if that's what you have to deal with every time you're on stage, then yeah, I'm supposed to. You do unfortunately get used to it.
Yeah. I mean, these Gen Z kids, good for them. Yeah. I applaud it. I was talking to a friend of mine the other night who came up with me in New York and comedy at the same time. And we were talking about how like, oh man, we put up with so much and it was just fine. Like, I mean, it wasn't fine, but we were like, I guess that's just the way the world is. And like, we would yell at each other about it, but we didn't know that we could be like, it's Scott Rude and stuff. Why are we going so off topic?
Oh, we're fine. We have a great editor too. So we're all going to be good.
Just that, I don't know if you know the Scott Rude stuff that's going on, but like he's being taken down for basically physical and emotional abuse at work, like not sexual abuse, not domestic abuse, but it's still bad to treat people like shit. And we're like, oh yeah, we got treated like shit a lot, but like, that was just the way the world was. It was like, well, do you want to keep doing this or do you want to quit this industry? So yay for the kids now changing it all. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good summation of it. And ultimately what has happened everywhere that the absolute worst has continued coming through and we're looking for ways to change it. But that's the history of the internet. And I feel like that really ties in well, because that is the biggest history of the internet. What we loved about it was the fact that it has opened up absolute world for us. It has allowed new voices to come through. What we've hated is the social media comment section that has allowed somehow equivalency of expertise and just blatant racism. That's it. Eliza Skinner, thank you so much for coming on today. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
It was a good time. Sorry about my cat.
Honestly, Kat, I wish we did this with video so we could keep the cat in. But guys, speaking of which, if you enjoyed the show, thank you for listening as well. We have a Patreon as well, which we're going to have down in the show notes, which we now have bonus Here's Where We Went Wrong with personal stories and video included of our own disasters. We'll have one up for this episode, so we hope you'll subscribe and check these out, because that was a lot of fun to make. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, give us 5 stars, and we'll be back next week. We'll hope you see you then. See you next week, Gwen.
Bye.
Bye.